Welcome to Geographical Thinking, a podcast full of ideas, stories, and conversations through the lens of geography. I'm your host, Guan Yu. In July, we brought you two conversations on climate change from Esri's Science of Wear podcast. The first chief heat officer in Los Angeles talked about how to create a more climate-adaptive city, and a business leader talked about how climate resilience is driving business decisions. Today, we're continuing this journey by showcasing climate change thought leaders. We're introducing you to James Hardcastle, Associate Director of the International Union for Conservation of Nature. James speaks with Esri's own David Gaston about the global initiative to protect 30% of the Earth by 2030, otherwise known as 30 by 30.
Hello, James.
Hello, David. Yeah, thanks very much for inviting me. I'm very excited to join and to share some insights with all your listeners.
Could you tell us about your work as the head of the Protected and Conserved Areas team? What's the mission and focus of that part of the organization?
We have one commission, expert commission, called the World Commission on Protected Areas. It numbers 2,500 individual experts who work on a daily basis on issues of protected area management, protected areas conservation, legal and regulatory, the whole range of skills and practices that go into protected areas. So I have that commission to engage with and to help focus their work, to help kind of support. And then I have a team of about 30 experts. We're from all over the planet. We're based everywhere. And our team is constantly on the hub of dialogue in different countries and different regions about the latest and greatest on protected and conserved areas. How can we make them more effective? How can we make them more equitable? How can we advise and guide governments on different standards that they can use? How can we inform policies? How can we help channel resources and funding? How can we really reach the people, the men and women who work at the coalface of nature conservation, you know, the park rangers, the people living in local communities? We have a mandate to engage with our Indigenous peoples organizations and their representatives and to really support their voice and their role and their rights, the vital work that they do in very important places on the planet to effectively manage their resources, determine future of conservation, a future that is natural and cultural and whole and supports their livelihoods in some of these very, very special places in the world.
So James, you have a really unique global view of this entire concept of protected areas and conserved and managed areas. What are some of the trends? What do you see emerging as correcting old practices or exploring more sustainable or equitable ways to keep these places safe?
Yeah, I think there's an idea that protected areas are kind of new. I mean, by new, I mean, you know, 150 years old since the US was the first country to formally have state designated protected areas. And this is not actually the case. That areas have been designated for nature conservation, for protection, for managing resources since time immemorial. You know, we have records from ancient Mongolia, you know, pre-BC, that they had, you know, reserves that were designated for, you know, horse rearing, for hunting, you know, all the way across Europe, the Roman Empire, they set aside areas for nature conservation in Lebanon. You know, the focus of Lebanon on the flag, the image is the cedar tree. You know, there's directives from Emperor Hadrian on protecting the Shuf Mountain area for cedar conservation, cedar replanting, because it was a crucial resource for the Romans for their shipbuilding. And right now through to today, the Cedar Reserve in Lebanon is one of the best protected areas in the world. It's got 2,000 years of history. But somehow we get fixated on the national park and the model that is this kind of state-led conservation. And that's really dominated the 20th century, for better or worse. That's been the model that many countries have adopted. However, there's many other ways to protect nature, to establish areas for nature conservation, for wildlife protection, habitat conservation, ecosystem restoration, the whole range of different services and interests that these areas can support.
So then what are some of the examples of how IUCN and the Protected and Conserved Areas team is working to advance effective management of conservation areas?
The methodologies and the thinking about how do you assess effectiveness has really evolved. And so there's now many protected areas, many governments have a methodology to look at their protected areas and look at what their objectives are. So what are we conserving here? We have a protected area for forest. This one's in wetland. So what are the key things that we're preserving? Is it wildlife? Is it the flow of the river? Is it for clean air? Is it for, you know, harvesting a local product? What is it? And is that working? Is that actually being managed towards that objective? And so this was really an evolution. And many governments adopted different methodologies, different tools, and began assessing the effectiveness. Began to change the thinking that we need to look at the effectiveness of protected and conserved areas, and we can't just establish them and throw some rangers in, pay them a little bit, and expect things to be great. It's really hard work, it's complex, and it takes a lot of time. The solutions are iterative. You need to learn by doing. You need to try something. If it works, great, carry on. If it doesn't, well, okay, let's try something different. So this thinking about effectiveness and about how it could be advanced is something that IUCN had been working on for about 20 years. When I joined the organization, we had an idea, and that was exactly to set the standard, and to set a standard that's really simple. And it just describes in a few words, a few principles, a few phrases, what do we mean by effectiveness? What is an effective protected area? What does it look like? And so we came up with a few principles and we expanded those, and then we added a few criteria under those principles. And everyone said, yeah, that looks pretty good. So we tested it. We worked in 8 countries to pilot it, and we took it down to the site level. We went with protected area managers and said, look, this is what we think effectiveness looks like. What do you reckon? And they're like, yeah, it looks pretty good. And we said, why don't you test yourself against it? And so they did. And we came up with a very novel verification scheme using the standards to help diagnose what needs to happen, where you're doing a good job. Like, yeah, you're doing great. Your governance is fantastic. Your management is quite effective. You have enough resources, but you're not monitoring your key values, or, you know, your design, your area is too small. You need to engage with this part or these partners. So we came up with a model standard that was accessible. It could be translated into different languages. It could be adapted just below the criteria. So, okay, how would this look like in your country? Well, we have this law, we have this kind of cultural practice, we have this designation. So, okay, let's factor that in. And so the standard can be globally consistent, but it can be adapted to different countries and worked in their language. So this has begun to take off. We call it the Green List standard, because the standard itself describes effective protected areas and conserved areas and any type of area-based conservation. But the idea is that if you can demonstrate that you meet the standard, our organization, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, IUCN, will add you to a list. And that list is a positive list. We will recognize your success and we will give you profile and we'll say, hey, guys, you are doing a great job. Your protected area, your national park, your community conserved area is delivering the conservation that you expect it to deliver. And that's based on your hard work and your efforts. Keep it up. And we will be there with you to help you keep it up. And all our members, all our partners are beholden to try and help these sites to meet that standard. But the excellence comes in achieving that across all of the different components of the Green List standard. So right now we are proposing that this standard, or a version of the standard, is adopted by more and more countries, and it becomes integrated into their planning, into their policies, and into their framing of effective area-based conservation to help them meet their commitments to the new global targets, to the United Nations Biodiversity Conservation Framework. And that we can then help in a very, very simple way, with a standard that is globally consistent, that can be adapted locally. We can help everyone improve and make incremental step-by-step progress towards, you know, achieving the grades that they like and being recognized for having successful area-based conservation units in their country.
How inclusive is the Green List? You mentioned the incredibly complex challenges facing many protected area managers and management organizations. But how does the Green List as a standard help illuminate different areas that are in need of improvement?
It can be adapted to the context of different countries so that we're globally consistent in what an effective protected area looks like. So you have good governance, you have excellent design, you have good planning, you have effective management and operations, and you can show conservation results. So those are kind of the main ingredients. But under that, there's a lot of context, there's a lot of nuance that can be adapted. So it's globally consistent, but locally appropriate, which makes it inclusive. And the idea that For example, we work a lot with Vietnam, and Vietnam's first national park is 60 years old this year. And they took the US model and they established a network of national parks and nature reserves, a formal ranger service, the whole structure there. But they always feel that they're not able. We're not really good enough. We don't have enough to invest. We're always one step behind. There's this kind of lack of confidence almost. But when we brought our standard to Vietnam and we adapted it, it's the same, it's consistent with the same standard we would use in California or would use in France or would use in United Arab Emirates or whichever other country that we're working. It's the same standard. But in Vietnam, they were then able to see, actually, we're doing pretty well. And they put forward a few sites. They put forward five protected areas as a test. And within 12 months, one of their nature reserves, Van Long Nature Reserve, had not only achieved our standard, but it actually really, really gone an extra level. It's called Van Long Nature Reserve, and it's near Hanoi. It's near the national capital. And the nature reserve has, since its designation, it's worked with the local community. They have economic engagement with people on tour boats. They have local rangers, from the community. They have an incentives. They have many programs that really support community engagement and share the governance of the area, the wetland and the mountains with local people. There is one of the world's rarest primate species. It's called the Delacour langur. It's a beautiful leaf monkey with long kind of tail, and it has these white pants on. So it's kind of quite cool. It's this white pant monkey is the other word for it, no? But it's Delacour langur. And the population of these langurs right next to Highway 1 in Vietnam, it was an isolated population. It went from about 30 to 40 individuals when it was designated 20 years ago. Now there's more than 300, 350, 400. And they're actually now a source population. They've reintroduced some of these langurs into two other areas nearby. The species has, that's 1,000% increase in 20 years. That is a conservation success. And now others in Vietnam, the directors of some other parks are saying, hey, how come that little nature reserve has got this IUCN recognition? We want that. We're doing a great job too. Can we join this green list? Can we have a look? Can we use the standard? Can you help us reach the target? So now we have, I think, 15 national parks now in Vietnam that are signed up. And this is the same in other countries. So it's really stimulate the focus on what works, the focus on rewarding good behavior, rewarding good investment, rewarding good policies, and rewarding political will. Is really powerful, and it cascades. So we're seeing an uptake in different countries where once one or two sites start using it, then you have this groundswell and there's this kind of peer engagement. It's something people can connect with. When you can see one of your peers doing something and doing it well and getting recognized, you say, hey, I want that. I can do that as well.
James, a two-part question. How are green list candidate sites assessed for consideration? And then let's say they achieve the standard, how are those sites monitored to verify that that level of management has continued?
Yeah, that's an excellent pair of questions. I think what's really important is that, we don't just give a recognition and give a certificate as a one-off. I don't want to give them a certificate and say, hey, you're great. Well done. You've done great conservation. And they're like, right, okay. Actually, we're not gonna protect the tigers anymore. We're gonna go do something else. Let's open it up for a theme park and keep our certificate. No way. So we have to build in a means that we can give the recognition, we can promote success, but we can keep the motivation to maintain those standards. And so we have a system whereby after 5 years, there's a quick reevaluation. And if nothing's changed, okay, you keep your certificate, everything's great. But we'd also put a couple of conditions. We'd also say, well, you can't just keep it the same. We want to see continuous improvement. So we can say, how about show us how you're improving gender equity in your park. So we can put a couple of conditions. We change the standard over time, make it a little bit tighter. So to encourage sites that are already on the list to keep improving. So on the fifth year, there's a reevaluation. And if everything's good, it's good. You keep your certificate, fantastic, well done, more recognition, more promotion, it's great. But we also have a system of triggers and alerts. The triggers could be a change in policy, a change in leadership. Often in protect and conserved areas, it really is individuals that make a difference. It could be a change in administration. This could raise an alarm, say, hold on a minute, your new director actually isn't in place yet. It's been 2 years, you have no leadership. That would trigger a review of the green list status, for example. It could be a natural disaster, forest fire, or a mass coral bleaching, or it could be a mine is opened in the It could be something like that. That would trigger a review. We have experts in each country who help us with the evaluation. So with our network, I mentioned IUCN has 15,000 experts, volunteer professional experts. We work with experts in protected and conserved areas in each country, and we accredit them as the evaluators, and we provide an assurance training, and an assurance provider checks that everything in the greenness process is done according to the rule book, is done according to the, you know, to the process that we outlined for the green list and the standard and how it's used. Or it could be somebody in the community or some stakeholder raises an alert. So for example, if you're a researcher with the university, you go there with a team and you discover that, you know, there's some illegal gold mining that nobody had mentioned before, you can raise that confidentially with IUCN. And we would then trigger a review to kind of just see if that is, if there's any basis to that claim and if that affects the status of the site for its, you know, for its recognition on the green list. So this system of alerts gives people living in and around the area, gives stakeholders, gives others a voice, and it makes the area accountable. If you're on the green list, you are accountable to your constituents to make sure you maintain those standards. Otherwise, they can put their hand up and say, hey guys, we don't think this protected area is performing up to the standards that you are recognizing it for. And we've had 3 or 4 cases already with our green list where these alerts have been raised and we've investigated, and we've actually prevented particular actions or policies or disturbances or infrastructure developments. So the greenness is actually having a disincentive for actors to kind of mess with the protected areas or kind of downgrade them or conduct negative activities. So that's quite powerful. So in some ways, the green list and the evaluation is it's bringing more accountability, it's bringing more visibility, and our role as an international organization that is known for our standards, our independence, our members, the expertise, you know, we have a crucial role in providing that independent evaluation, that independent verification that, yes, you're doing a good job, or that, no, there's an issue that needs addressing here. It's positive, it's optimistic. And so we can turn over time, if more and more countries adopt standards and adopt this approach, we can start to turn around that 75% of the world's protected and conserved areas that are not managed effectively. Our aim is to really get 3/4 of the world's protected areas using the standard and showing improvement, to really encourage people to use it, to understand it, to apply it in their daily work, and really get that recognition, get people mobilized, get the support that men and women need to do their work on the ground.
The importance of conserving biodiversity and restoring nature appears to be increasing in global awareness and increasingly mainstream. Why do you think that's the case in the context of other pressing issues?
Well, I think we have to thank our younger generations. I think we have to thank the digital era that we live in. Information travels fast. And even though, as we all know, everywhere, you know, you can't necessarily trust all the information you're receiving, I think that there's an overwhelming groundswell of information about the importance of the environment. And I think the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis are, you know, gaining traction in terms of what young people are thinking about. And they're becoming more active. And I think that that's also filtering up. You can see the change in government positions to climate change. Business are getting on board as well. And it's, there is a groundswell. There needs to be much, much, much more. But I think that you cannot take away the health of our environment, the health of ecosystems, the state of our natural world underpins our own health, happiness, development, and well-being. And the recent pandemic that we're now nearly out of is a really good example of where that rub, that friction, the degradation of natural ecosystems and the kind of the overspill of human interaction with wildlife has created an increasing risk of zoonotic disease transfer. So this is, you know, disease coming from wildlife to domestic animals to people. And, you know, the risk of pandemics is really, really high. This, I think, has helped raise awareness as well of the need for better wildlife protection, the need for protecting conserved areas, the need for a healthy environment. So just from that side, I think from the other side is all those people around the world who were under lockdown, restricted movements, the need for green spaces, for fresh air, for trees, be on the beach, just to get out into nature was really really pressing, and I think people felt it hard. And now that people are starting to come out, I think there's a higher appreciation of the value of these green spaces. And we as an organization are trying to really promote the role of protected and conserved areas in supporting people's health, the role in protected and conserved areas in being kind of the front line of detection of new events, and having the capacities in these places are often very remote, very wild. You have a veterinary surgeon, you have rangers monitoring wildlife, you have the ability to monitor changes in the landscape, changes in wildlife, changes that may occur that could be a risk for another spillover event or another pandemic. So I think it's really important we don't forget the lessons of the last 2-3 years, but we actually really take the opportunity as part of this whole 30 by 30. A part of the new commitments to the biodiversity crisis, to the climate crisis, to really link that to a health crisis. And that's mental health, spiritual health, physical health, really, really important that we have access to nature, and the value of nature is one of our key strategies to keep people safe, keep people healthy.
James, this has been an incredible education. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
James Hardcastle is the Associate Director of the International Union for Conservation of Nature. This podcast is brought to you by Esri Canada, a technology company that empowers people and organizations by the science of wear. Bye for now.